From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in today for Celeste Headlee. What does it mean to be a journalist these days?
You know, at any point, anyone today can become the most important journalist in the world. You know, if you're in the right place at the right time and you have your phone, sending out one sentence could change the world.
Today we're going to talk about training the next generation of journalists, or even if they need to be trained. The kids, they know how to use the Twitter these days all by themselves. We're going to learn about a new program that teaches the value of long-form journalism in a media landscape that is full of tweets, YouTube, and Facebook posts. Then we're going to give you an update about the publisher of a small Georgia newspaper who was arrested after he filed an open records request. That's coming up this hour, but first, a survey found that older people are less likely to pay for music than young people. Why? We posed this question to the break room on Friday. Here's what Sam Burnham had to say.
Older people are used to buying things. They bought a CD, they bought a tape, they bought a record album. There was something that they were buying they could hold in their hands.
It was tangible. See digital.
If you're buying a song that's on digital format, you're not thinking about, well, somebody had to do a lot of work to put this together.
So he asked, do you pay for music? Here are your first thoughts.
This is Jane Tolton calling from Rome, Georgia. I'm 64 years old. I grew up in the era where there was free TV, free radio. People of our age do not like to have fees on everything. We grew up in a different era of this digital age. If you download something digitally onto a device, then that device crashes, you've lost that music. If I own an LP or a CD, I have it forever. So it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, because LPs aren't prone to loss or damage. Anyway, Brian Harkins writes on Twitter, I use Spotify majority of the time. Certain indie artists like Bonnie Prince Billy aren't on the service, so I buy their records. Well, let's listen to a little bit of Bonnie Prince Billy. Here is I See a Darkness.
That I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness. Did you know how much I love you? There's a hope that somehow you could save me from this darkness.
That's cool, that's worth paying for. We always want to know what you think, and here's where I acknowledge the irony that we were just decrying the Twitter and Facebookization of news, and now I'm going to give our social media coordinates so that you can Twitter and Facebook us. Or you can call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. So journalism, and especially the business that supports it, has been in a state of profound change for about 20 years now, and much of that change has been bad. The Washington Post reports that when compared to similar careers like public relations, salaries in journalism are lower, positions are being whittled away, and the overall outlook for future journalists seems to trend downward. And long-form journalism faces its own particular struggle in our current media landscape. The rise of social media has forced many news outlets to focus on higher quantities of stories rather than longer, more thoughtful pieces. But one University of Georgia professor has not given up on the old long-form narrative journalism. Valerie Boyd heads up a Master of Fine Arts writing program that encourages students to become engaged and effective news storytellers. Professor Boyd joins us now to tell us more about her innovative program. Welcome, Professor Boyd.
Thank you.
So tell us about this. MFA programs are pretty common, but they generally teach fiction or literary nonfiction. Talk about applying that model to journalism.
Yeah, so you're getting right at the heart of what our program is. Our program is trying to bridge that false divide between journalism and literature. We are the first MFA program housed at a college of journalism in the country.
Wow.
And our thinking behind that is that journalists can write about anything. Journalists can turn the lens outward and write about the world. Most of MFA programs in creative nonfiction or fiction, you know, those programs, poetry, of course, they're based in literature departments. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of those creative nonfiction programs, students are writing memoir or personal essay. They're pretty much writing about themselves. Yeah. Our program is, because it's at the Grady College of Journalism, one of the top journalism schools in the country, our idea is that we want to equip journalists to write factual literature, is what I call it, literature that's based in fact and reporting, you know, but good journalistic writing that rises to the level of literature. I think there's always been this false divide, like there's journalists and then there's literary writers. I mean, many of the books that are on the New York Times bestseller list in nonfiction are beautifully written books that rise to the level of literature. And our program is trying to create and encourage students to move into that realm.
And I don't know, I know that we don't like to obsess about marketability of skills in higher education, but it's a reality. How do you talk about this in your program where long form is not exactly the hottest commodity on the journalism market these days?
Well, it may not be the hottest commodity on the journalism market, but the fact is nonfiction books sell better these days than fiction books. So we're really pushing people toward writing long form, like really going for narrative nonfiction books that have a journalistic foundation, you know, books that are rooted in solid reporting and research, but that are written in a way that's literary that, you know, reads like a novel and keeps people turning those pages. We also
could you give us a sense of Go ahead. Could you give us a sense of some of the projects that your students have been working on? Maybe just list a few?
Sure. We have a current student. Let me just remind you that this program is brand new. We just finished our first year. But that being said, we have some great students who are working on book-length projects. We have one student who's been spending time with Georgia oyster fishermen, and he's writing a book about that that's going to be published by UGA Press. We have another student who's writing about dealing with her mother's Alzheimer's, writing a book about this and kind of the issue of looking at her own predisposition to Alzheimer's because it's genetic while, you know, ushering her mother, you know, into the next realm. But this is a journalist. This is a woman who is in our program, but she teaches journalism at Southern Methodist University. You know, she is an experienced journalist who's bringing those journalistic skills to this personal story, but also looking at Alzheimer's in the African-American community because that's the community she's from. So it's a really interesting opportunity for students to take their own interests, their journalistic skills, which some of them come in with, others we teach those journalistic skills, and then combine that with really literary, high-quality writing.
Do you see any distinction between literary nonfiction and long-form journalism, or is it an entirely false dichotomy?
Well, I see them as part of the larger umbrella. In my view, there's kind of a large tent called narrative nonfiction or literary nonfiction, and narrative journalism is a part of that, and that would be what I would call long-form journalism, the kinds of magazine pieces that are still very much important and in demand. I mean, you know, we talk about, say, you've heard of the slow food movement, which is obviously a backlash or a response to the fast food movement.
We need slow news.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
I think that's what we're doing. We're experiencing this kind of slow news movement where we're saying, yes, we want the daily story. We want it on a tweet. We want it as quickly as possible. Give us the headlines, but then step back and give us the real story. Give us the you know, the complexity and the context that we need to understand why these things are happening in our world. And especially now with so many crazy things happening in our world, we need journalists to step back, take a breath, and help us to understand it all. And that's what slow journalism can do.
We're talking to Valerie Boyd. She heads up a new MFA program at the University of Georgia that teaches long-form narrative journalism. It's the first of its kind in the country. And I suppose at this point I should disclose my personal connection to this story. For anyone who doesn't know, I'm on the faculty at Mercer University Center for Collaborative Journalism, which is another new journalism model. And in that capacity, I have collaborated on a couple of things with David Armstrong, who's director of the Georgia News Lab, a student-led project that focuses on teaching investigative journalism techniques to students from universities across the region. Armstrong is a professor at Georgia State University, and he joins our conversation now. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Say hi to Valerie.
Hi, Valerie. How are you?
Hey,
we've been speaking.
Okay. So, David, you know, you're an old school investigative newspaper guy. What do you make of Valerie's program?
Well, I think it's interesting, and I think that there are a whole lot of things that are happening right now that are trying to reinvent journalism in a way. The model broke, and it's sort of putting Humpty Dumpty back together again with new components and new formulas. And that's certainly one of the places. There is a revival of long-form journalism. There's quite a bit of interest in it. I mean, it may be somewhat boutique in the sense that it's going to be splintered off, and it may not be coming out of the same places it did before, but it's certainly happening, and there's certainly a lot of interest, and I think, as Valerie pointed out, there's a lot of attention to it. It's in the book field, in magazine writing, and elsewhere. So it's part of the future for sure.
Well, let's turn the corner now and just talk more generally about how we should be teaching journalism these days, new models in teaching this trade that we all still believe in quite passionately, and I think that our listeners believe in it. Otherwise, they wouldn't be listening to a news show right now. David, tell us about the Georgia News Lab.
Sure. The Georgia News Lab is a collaborative investigative reporting initiative. It's a partnership between five area universities, along with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and WSB-TV. Students spend a year learning the techniques and strategies of investigative reporting. They work side by side with their professional colleagues. They produce real-world major investigative stories, and the top students then roll into summer internships embedded with the investigative teams at the AJC and WSB. So the purpose is to make investigative reporting affordable. When journalism broke a few years ago, investigative journalists were the first to go because they were the most expensive. So by training young people to do it, we're able to...
Oh, you're replacing them with undergraduates. That
should
work.
I'm replacing all my friends with my students. It's a way of the organizations that want to be able to do this kind of work can do it affordably with young people who have data, who are data savvy, digitally savvy, telling great stories on new platforms in new ways. And the other important component of it is that we built into our DNA a diversity component. For years, there had been this concern that the industry in general, but investigative reporting in particular, was simply too white. And we wanted to do something about trying to make that change. So our partners in the project are three historically black colleges and universities, along with Georgia State, which is highly diverse, and UGA as well. And we have a high component, a high ratio of African-American and minority students who are training to do this very important work, getting opportunities they wouldn't get otherwise, and able to, as we hope, move into newsrooms and bring new perspectives into those newsrooms, tell stories, dig stories about communities that have historically been poorly covered, and tell those stories to people who can appreciate what's going on and learn things that they wouldn't know but for the hard work of these students and in their current roles and in their future capacities as professional investigative reporters.
Well, stick around, guys. We're going to talk a little bit more about this after a break. That's David Armstrong. He's director of the Georgia News Lab and a professor at Georgia State University. Also with us is Professor Valerie Boyd, director of the Narrative Nonfiction Program at the University of Georgia. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Do you take the time to read long-form news stories? Is that something that you prioritize? What subjects deserve more in-depth coverage? What do you think the journalists of tomorrow need to learn how to do? What do you want from them? Tweet us now at OST Talk, and we would love to read your tweets on the air. This is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Today we're considering the future of journalism. How do educators help prepare the next generation of reporters, editors, and news managers? What principles and techniques are most important to pass on? And how important are media ethics in our current culture? University of Georgia Professor Valerie Boyd and Professor David Armstrong of Georgia State University are with us. And joining us now to talk about kind of even the younger generation is Connie Grabel. She's a journalism and English teacher at Lee County High School in Leesburg, Georgia. Hello, Connie.
Hey.
I said your name right. Wrong. No, it's Connie Grabel.
Grabel.
I got it.
That's okay.
Thank you for coming up all the way from Leesburg. That's down around Albany, is that correct?
Right, between Albany and Americus.
So how do you get high schoolers down there interested in journalism?
Well, they come in usually because they have one particular skill they want to build. A lot of times I get somebody who comes in because they want to be a photographer. I get somebody who comes in because they're a writer. And then you make sure they understand that it's much more than that, that you want staff members that can do it all. But once they're in there, over the years, if your program is what it should be, you build a reputation for being more, we're not high school reporters, we're high school journalists, and mm-hmm. for learning the difference and what goes into that.
And are there a lot of students who are into it, who seem optimistic about it as a career path, or is it just something they're dabbling in as we do when we're in high school and college?
Well, sometimes they come in as a dabble, but they usually leave knowing if they want to go into the profession, what area they want to go into. One of the current trends is, as your other guests were just talking, mm-hmm. The college programs have moved to more of a converged journalism. You no longer have a broadcasting major, a print major,
right.
a magazine major. It's a converged model, and that's what we're doing in high schools, too. My kids run 3 publications out of 1 staff and 1, class time.
Yeah.
And because they do that, they have to be very organized, but they also have to learn every aspect of the trade. They have to learn how to work the cameras. They have to learn how to edit their own work or others. They have to learn how to give an interview or conduct an interview that'll really dig and find the real story. So, but they're pretty positive about it. If you had asked me 2 years ago if my students felt positive about the future of journalism, I'd have a very different answer.
Huh.
But right now, I think because they're aware that the collegiate programs have changed and they're aware that this doesn't mean print is dead, it means that print has a different format and you have to be creative with it, they're much more encouraged by the industry as a career.
Valerie Boyd at UGA, how does that make you feel to hear that?
That makes me feel great. Send your students my way, Connie.
I'd love to. You have several, but I'd love to.
Yeah, I want to add to what Connie said. I think journalism is not, it is broke, as David pointed out, but we're fixing it. We're working to fix it. And it's not dead. And I have friends who are former journalists who are surprised that I still have students. They're like, people are still majoring in journalism? And yeah, we have a lot of journalism majors because they understand the power of journalists. In your intro, you talked about, anybody can become a journalist. They can tweet. They can send out a Facebook message, all of that. That's all true. Social media kind of takes away the gatekeepers in a way and makes it, it levels the playing field. Anybody can write about anything. So it gives everyone access to being journalists, but trained journalists know how to approach a story ethically. They know how to dig deep for the interview, like Connie talked about, to really get at real issues and important questions. So there's some training that we can give to these young people to help them really tell stories that matter. And they get that, and that's why they flock to Connie's class, they flock to, David's and my programs, So we are not experiencing, I don't think, a dearth of journalism students. We just have to give them the training so that they can really deal in this complex world.
Yeah, David Armstrong at Georgia State, Georgia News Lab. Your program and my program at Mercer very much built on the idea that students need real-world experience while they are training in college at real professional publications. It used to be that the primary training ground for collegiate journalists was at the college newspaper. And certainly lots of schools still have amazing college newspapers that do really, really strong work. But, one reason that we're putting them into professional newsrooms is because there's fewer adult professional journalists to work in those newsrooms and they need help. But what's the benefit to students?
There's no question. It's interesting listening to this conversation. To hear a journalist talking about the future of journalism this optimistically, I think would have shocked people a few years ago. Yeah. But things are changing. And as you point out, these collaborations are really where the future is. There's no question about it. The organizations that want to do this on more limited resources than in the past are looking for young people to come in and be able to do this more affordably. Giving them the training and the background and the skills to be able to do it makes it all the more possible. And the benefit for the news organizations, on top of just having people who can do the work, is they're bringing bringing the ideas, the new technologies, the new stories, the new perspectives into those newsrooms. They are the future of journalism. There's no question about it. You have these large megaphones, in a sense, these traditional outlets that can get the stories out. They're very good at that. There's been a breakdown in the way that news is gathered, collected, told, the subjects, but there are enthusiastic young people who want to do this work. They're getting opportunities to get great training, work with professionals, and bring their perspectives, their facile ability with digital, with data, into those newsrooms, and able to do the things that in the past weren't possible. We don't know what it is yet, but I think the young people who are coming along are really the key to what journalism is going to look like in the future, and it's very hopeful that there are these programs out there who are able to train them.
Connie Grable, you're teaching at the high school level.
Talk
to us about how your students seem to relate to the concept of ethics in media. Are they concerned about it, or are they sort of wrapped up in the prevailing report first, ask questions later thing that seems to have taken over so many once august publications?
Well, they'd better not be. But we begin the year each year with our first instruction, because remember, we're a newsroom, but we also are a classroom. Mm-hmm. We begin the beginning of every year with a refresher course on journalistic ethics. And I can make a heck of a test when I want to, and you know, it is still school, but they don't get to have anything published with us until I know that they've got a handle on ethics. And we talk about the most current issues in the news with journalistic ethics, and we do different scenarios, and I tell them the kind of questions that I think they're going to have to deal with the most. My program has a really strong background in journalistic ethics for one reason, though. We are an open forum. You have different forms of autonomy within journalism or among journalistic schools. Mm-hmm. In high schools or middle schools, you'll have an open forum, which means kids decide all the content. You might have a limited forum, which is a combination of that and adults. And then you have a prior review where somebody looks at everything and gives permission for it to be published.
Right, yeah.
Ours is an open forum, which means they can censor each other. I won't censor them.
Wow, that's so putting a lot of trust in some very young people.
It is, and that is why I scare them to death with the ethics first. And we really go, because if you're going to give them that kind of responsibility, you've also got to give them the knowledge to judge it with. Now, let me go back and clarify. Mm-hmm. My student editors can censor each other. And there are a few reasons that you can pull, that I could pull an article. And they're very spelled out. And it's the same kind of, if it's the type of speech that's not protected by the First Amendment, if it's not true, if it doesn't tell the whole story, if it slanders someone without evidence or libel, if it is an intentional dig, then I could pull it for that.
Yeah, no, we know that you're being responsible down there, but you're also giving the kids a lot of autonomy, and that's great.
Right.
And it's very exciting to hear everyone talk in this segment about the future of our beloved profession, and that it does have a future, and that there is money to be made and good work to be done. And please, 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 if you're talented, if you like making stuff, if you want to save the world, ours is the major to go with, right?
Right.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Okay. Valerie Boyd is professor at UGA, the director of narrative nonfiction there. David Armstrong is director of the Georgia News Lab, professor at Georgia State University. Connie Grable teaches journalism and English at Lee County High School. Thank you so much to all of you. Now, an update to a story we've followed for the last year. Felony charges remain for a North Georgia newspaper publisher named Mark Thomason and his attorney. They were arrested last month in Fannin County after Thomason filed an open records request. He requested canceled checks for the operating expenses of two area judges. One of them was Brenda Weaver of the Appalachian Judicial Circuit. She moved forward with the charges against Thomason. Weaver has said she worried Thomason would misuse her personal banking information. First Amendment advocates and organizations like the Society of Professional Journalists are outraged over the arrest of a watchdog journalist. District Attorney Allison Sosby filed a motion to drop the charges against Mark Thomason earlier this month. But late last week, the judge who would have signed off to dismiss the case refused to do so. Instead, Senior Court Judge Richard Weingarten called for a hearing on the request to dismiss. Since the charges haven't been dropped, Thomason says neither have conditions of his bail. Those include random drug tests and searches of his home and office without a warrant. He also can't be within 200 yards of certain people, many of whom are county employees. Thomason says that makes it pretty hard to do his job.
We're a small community, so most meetings take place at the courthouse, election board meetings, water authority meetings, county commission meetings, tax assessor meetings, and those are things that I can't cover at the moment. You know, actually early voting is taking place at the courthouse. I can't go vote.
Thomason must appear today before Judge Weingarten to see if the charges will be dropped. GPB reporter Sean Powers has more on this story out of Fannin County. Visit gpbnews.org for the latest updates. Seeds are planted for the city of Atlanta to host the 1996 Summer Olympic Games decades before the winning bid was announced. It was a long shot. Atlanta was up against larger, more established cities like Toronto and Athens, Greece, that is. But Ambassador and former Mayor Andrew Young believed that Atlanta offered something that the other cities could not. He shares how he succeeded in bringing the Olympic Games to the city when the odds were stacked against him.
Well, I was just about to leave the mayor's office in 1988 when Billy Payne and Horace Sibley and Charlie Battle came into my office to talk about the Olympics. Well, I'd always wanted to go to the Olympics since I was 4 years old. So the Olympics were part of a dream of mine. Well, I had been at the United Nations for 3 years before I became mayor. And so I kind of knew my way around the world. And there were only 72 countries that had Olympic representation. And when I counted, I knew somebody in 55 of the 72 countries. Not that I knew them personally, but they had a consulate here in Atlanta. I knew people who knew influential people in the businesses of those countries. It was simply a matter of making the connections. But what we realized was that almost anywhere in the world, there were people from those countries who were successful. I remember the Polish community, and I didn't even know we had a Polish community, invited the Polish delegate to come to Atlanta. And he stayed in their homes, and they showed him around. And they invited him not only to vote for the Olympics for Atlanta, but to bring the athletes' families with them, and they could stay in their homes free of charge as their guests. There were any number of instances, but we didn't spend a lot of money entertaining people. We just invited them into our homes. When the African delegation came to my home and we fixed a good, what we thought a southern dinner, one of the gentlemen from Congo shouted out, Andy, you served us African food. I said, no, this is just the food we eat. He said, same we eat in Africa. And so we got most of the African votes. I think everybody found something to be comfortable with. Everybody was happy. Everybody came here and felt at home. And so we ended up getting 53. Of the 82 votes.
That's Ambassador and former Atlanta Mayor Andrew Young. Would you want to see Atlanta host something on the scale of an international event like the Olympics again? Tell us at 404-500-9457, on Twitter at OST Talk, or post to our Facebook page. This is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa in for Celeste Henley. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs reports that up to 20% of vets who served in Iraq and Afghanistan have post-traumatic stress disorder. That means a return to civilian life can be a battle all its own for servicemen and women. This week, the Macon Film Festival puts the story of one veteran with PTSD up on the big screen. Alex Sutton came back from war with mental and physical scars, but he has a special approach to help soothe his war wounds. It's farming.
My grandfather was a Korean War vet. He came back from the war and he bought 40 acres. I seen how happy it made my grandpa.
That's farmer and veteran Alex Sutton in the documentary Farmer Veteran, Farmer slash Veteran. Alex Blair is the filmmaker behind that project, and she joins us now from Vermont. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Look forward to seeing your film at the festival. I'm down in Macon myself. We also have John Jackson on the line from Milledgeville. He's a Georgia veteran who started a farm there. John now works with fellow veterans who face the challenge of adjustment to life after war, and he joins us by Skype from Milledgeville. Thanks for being here, John.
Hey, thanks to be on the show, guys.
And for more on how exactly farming can help those with post-traumatic stress disorder is Melinda Page. She teaches clinical mental health counseling at Argosy University in Atlanta. Melinda, good to have you with us, too.
Thank you.
So let's go back to Alex. This is your film. What attracted you to the story?
Yes, thank you. So I was working in North Carolina with a nonprofit doing outreach to farmers in the state of North Carolina, and I met veteran Alex Sutton while I was doing that work. And I had previously done a story about a farmer veteran in California for a radio show, and so my brain was kind of primed to be very curious about how agriculture can be a good match for veterans. I also come from a family of farmers and veterans, so maybe I was biased from the beginning. But when I met Alex Sutton, he was just beginning to farm. It was kind of the perfect storm that a friend of mine who became our producer of the film and our editor, D.L. Anderson, was just forming a documentary collective in Durham, North Carolina. And he partnered me with Jeremy Lang, who would become the co-director on this film with me. So I had just met Alex Sutton, very curious and interested in how agriculture can be healing, as well as being very hard, being a good match for veterans. And then there was this documentary group starting. So that was the birthing of this film 5 years ago.
Okay. Well, let's listen to a clip from Farmer Veteran. This is a scene that, I don't know what to say, folks. This does not go where you think it's going to go. This is a scene in which Alex Sutton is on his farm with some of the baby chicks that he's been raising. Let's listen.
Just to watch this little bitty plant come out of the ground out of nothing. It's like, wow. Or just hold an egg in your hand. But no, at this moment, I control that whole chick's world.
It's an adrenaline rush, you know? I get the same feel from watching my babies hatch as I did pulling a trigger of a 50 cal and watching somebody's head explode.
So, Alex Blair, do you remember filming that? What went through your head?
Yes, I mean, Alex Sutton is full of contradictions. I think that's part of why this film is so incredible and made a really huge turn from what we thought we were filming when we started and then where we are now 5 years later. And I think part of that was this crazy contradiction of just what he said and what made me curious about it as we filmed is kind of paying attention to these contradictions of educating ourselves more to, like, you think war is so horrific and combat, and it is. And yet for many veterans coming back, there is also this really powerful positive experience, which I think has a lot to do with the camaraderie and, you know, brotherhood, sisterhood that forms by being in that experience. And so one thing I noticed in Alex Sutton is just this this duality, this very tense, powerful duality of having a ton of pride in his soldiering experience, and then also this deep pain and trauma. And I think as we've done research and interviewed many, many other veterans, that is a very common thing to happen. Alex is a very unique case, and I hope everyone will go see the film to find out how unique he is. But that was one of the things as I was filming. I mean, there were moments where I was like, man, I'm a civilian. I just don't understand what he's talking about, and I want to understand more.
Well, luckily, we have another veteran with us. We've got John Jackson, who's a veteran farmer in Milledgeville. John, when you hear that clip, what does that make you think? I mean, I suppose that farming and combat actually have more than a few things in common with each other, one of them being just that you're constantly holding life in your hands.
First of all, that's an amazing clip, amazing dialogue between a fellow vet, and you guys are doing some amazing things. One of the things that when people ask me, they say, hey, you know, why are you farming? Is it because of, you know, you're finding your peace and this and that? And I have to tell them, anybody that knows about farming, I tell them, no, man, because it's chaotic. It's like war. And it's, I mean, you know, we're in war. We're always at the struggle of balancing, you know, happiness under the dark cloak, you know, and it's a struggle. You know, your buddies are dying. There's things going on around you. You know, on the farm, we kind of get that same thing, too. I mean, you got, especially if you're farming organically, you know, you have disease, pests, things like that. Animals get sick. You know, you're constantly fighting against Mother Nature. And it's a beast. And when you get a handle of it or handle on it and you actually get those small victories, they're truly, truly rewarding. Seeing a chick, seeing the birth of one of my piglets, you know, watching animals, watching our crop grow, do really well. Those are like small rewards from a long line of hard work that we put in. And it's so worth it.
But having to slaughter animals or having to put down animals who are sick, does any of that ever trigger anything for you?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I'm conditioned to death. So one of the things that I find with farming and why I created this place on Comfort Farms is that we are missing the mark with dealing with veterans with regards to conditioning them. I was conditioned to be a soldier. It took me a long time to do that. And then on day one of me leaving the military, they say, hey, you're a civilian again. No, that's wrong. That's not going to happen. But on the farm kind of works as a way to condition us back to some sort of normalcy. I go out, one of my animals die, if I have to slaughter them and things like that, you know, I just do what I have to do. It's part of the job. What I'm constantly thinking and reevaluating is, how do I do it better? Why did that animal get sick? Is that animal happy when it goes to slaughter? You know, I'm doing a service right now for customers, for veterans who come in here to make this farm like fully comprehensive in a way where it's all synergy. Everything is connected and your actions are connected, just like on a battlefield. Everything you do has a consequence, versus it, whether it's positive or negative. I have guys right here right now who are going through crisis, who they come to the farm immediately. They let their guard down. They jump right into the business of farming, and we're able to connect on a level that they weren't able to connect to two weeks ago when they were about to commit suicide. So there's some amazing things that goes on at the farm with regards to vets, and it's all part of the job.
We're talking about farming as a way home for veterans here on Second Thought. That's John Jackson. He's a farmer veteran in Milledgeville. You've been hearing about the farm that he runs and the services that he provides there. Also with us is filmmaker Alex Blair. This conversation is apropos of her film Farmer Veteran. It is screening at the Macon Film Festival this week. Also with us is Melinda Page. And Melinda is a professor of mental health, studies these issues at Argosy University in Atlanta. Melinda, we talk about how difficult it can be for veterans to return to the workforce and all of the problems that they can encounter, but can occupations themselves actually be therapeutic?
Yes, absolutely. And what I love about hearing about this program is that it provides that profound transformative healing experience that veterans need when they return. They need an experience that's the antithesis of the traumatic event itself that creates community and life and brings them together with a new mission.
On the other hand, though, veterans have a lot of troubling experiences around returning to the workforce, right?
Absolutely. They're acculturating, as you heard John mention, and they have to acculturate again, you know, get familiar with the culture of being a civilian, and that's what this program supports.
Sure. Alex Blair, in making your film about your subject, Alex Sutton, don't want to confuse mm-hmm. you two.
I know.
where did you see him struggling?
Well, we first started seeing him struggling at the first winter, which I think is normal because winter is hard as a farmer.
Yeah.
One thing that I've always been really humbled by is that the USDA counts a beginning farmer as someone in their first 10 years of operation. That's the definition
wow.
in their beginning farmer and rancher development program. And you think about that, like any other profession we do, 10 years, you're pretty much an expert, you know, but in farming 10 years, you're still considered a beginner. And just understanding that how hard it is. I mean, John spoke really beautifully to that. Like, you're at the mercy of the weather. You're learning all these things. You have to be like 8 different professions, accountant, businessman, biologist, you know, soil scientist. You have to be all of that. Long hours, massive physical toll, you know, doing most of it yourself and taking, you know, the losses and the problems yourself as well. And so the first winter came, Alex Sutton and his girlfriend, who became his wife over the course of our film, were doing it, the two of them themselves, extremely smart, capable people, and yet doing heritage birds for the first time ever. They were starting with poultry. And had, you know, were beginners. And so they, like John was mentioning, they got some sick birds. They were learning as they went and maybe like took on a little too much for the first year. And so then winter hit. And I think one thing that's unique and also maybe not unique to our main character, Alex Sutton, is he has so much pride in what he does. And he spent 13 years in the military with this warrior soldier identity, just like Melinda was saying really yeah. articulately, like he was in a culture of war and combat, and that was his identity. And then he left that and is trying to be an amazing farmer. And so the first time you have something go wrong, which it will in farming, he took that really hard. And that was kind of at the point in the film where we started to notice like some deeper problems. Like we knew he was struggling with PTSD. We knew the amount of medication he was on. But when winter hit and the farm started taking a tumble, his identity is so wedded to the farm that then we started noticing deeper things about his story and how much the legacy of war causes its own war when you come home.
Yeah, it's amazing how much having something to do with every minute of every day can really paper over problems that you are encountering and you don't feel them until you mm-hmm. have some time off. Melinda, I wonder if you could talk about the solitary aspect of farming. Do vets tend to do better in jobs where they can have some space and be to themselves, or do they do better in professions where they're part of a team?
I believe they do better when they have a shared mission. They're extremely resilient, strong individuals, and since PTSD is a medical condition, it's a treatable medical condition, it means their brain is simply injured by the high stress that they've lived with and can be healed. So they can work in a solitary environment, they can work as a team. They're healthy, strong men and women. They simply need medical treatment for PTSD, which is actually an injury to the brain.
Yeah, considered a physical injury rather than a mental health condition, is that right?
Yes, it's a change in the structure of the limbic cortex. That's the emotional brain that will heal over time, especially with programs like this one.
John Jackson, you're a farmer in Milledgeville. You run this program, this farm called Comfort Farms. Where does the name come from?
Glad you ask. I hope I don't get emotional. But I was a United States Army Ranger. I served 6 tours over the past 11 years, special operations. And back in May 8th of 2010, my buddy Kyle A. Comfort, Captain Kyle A. Comfort, ranger buddy of mine, got killed in action overseas. And it was a way for me, you know, over my time after we left, it was a way for me to kind of give back. I found that I had traumatic brain injury from being in IEDs and things like that. I am 100% disabled with chronic post-traumatic stress disorder, seen a lot of combat, saw a lot of guys get killed, did a lot of missions and things like that. So I was suicidal at one point, and I was trying to find my way and trying to find programs to kind of help a vet like myself. There was none that existed. So I pretty much grabbed the bull by the horns. I created a nonprofit called Stag Vets, Inc., which is Strength to Achieve Greatness. And we created our first program, which is Comfort Farms. It's actually the Acute Veterans Crisis Agriculture Center, where we actually take in veterans who are going through some acute crisis, and we absorb them in the business of agriculture. And we're using it as agritherapy. And I think it's a great way for me to give back to my buddy Kyle Comfort, who has given so much to me while we were deployed.
That's great.
Melinda Page, yes. Over at Argosy University, with our last minute here, last 30 seconds really, what's one thing that everyone should be doing to better serve vets who are coming back into our community?
Validate for them that there's nothing wrong with these men and women. They have a shift in the way the brain is functioning from the high stress loads that they've endured, and the brain will heal through neural plasticity and programs where they're participating in community and coming together around a positive mission and cause. This is a treatable medical condition.
It's Melinda Page of Argosy University. We were talking with farmer and veteran John Jackson. Check out Comfort Farms in Milledgeville. Also, check out the film Farmer Veteran. It is screening Friday afternoon at 1:30 at the Douglas Theater in Macon as part of the Macon Film Festival. Alex Blair, the filmmaker, has been with us. Thank you, Alex, and I can't
wait
to see it.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for On Second Thought today. On tomorrow's show, we're going to revisit the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta. Can you believe it's been 20 years? Let us know your memories at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea.